This is an ABC podcast.
Peter Papathanasiou was born in Greece, but he came to Australia as a baby. He studied science at university and was about to begin a PhD in genetics when one hot January day, his mum said she needed to talk to him. That day she told Peter a secret about his past, one that revealed his family wasn't the way he had grown up believing. Peter's memoir is called Little One. Hi, Peter. Welcome to Conversations.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
So when you were growing up, was that part of a big Greek community? Were there lots of other Greek families near yours?
We had a Greek community within. I grew up in Canberra, and my parents had Greek friends, people that they'd met since coming to Australia or people that they knew from Greece when they all migrated here in the 1950s.
And how did they try to keep the Greek heritage alive and in you?
Oh, by trying to embarrass their kids as much as possible.
What did that involve?
Well, you know, when you're a little kid, it was. You pushed back against that culture. You know, you didn't want to speak Greek to your parents in front of your friends. You definitely didn't want to wear a fustanella, you know, national costume, which I have worn.
Did you find yourself wearing that?
Usually at a little festival or something, you know, maybe at church once. You didn't want to eat Greek food, you know, you wanted to have fish and chips and burgers with your friends, you know, not this oily, you know, smelly. It's just this resistance we had as we were kids.
What did your dad do for work when you were growing up?
Dad was a handyman, a carpenter. You know, he was self-taught. So, yeah, I mean, he worked on government buildings in Canberra. He worked on private residencies. You know, he would often drive past a new suburb and he'd point at the houses and say, "You see that? I built those houses." So, and he did a lot of stuff around the house, and it kind of meant that we were able to save a lot of money, but the backyard and a lot of the parts of the house had a bit of a junkyard quality.
Well, what kind of craftsman was your dad?
Oh, he was everything. He was an electrician and he was a carpenter and he was a mechanic. There was nothing he could, he was a painter, nothing he couldn't do.
Nothing he couldn't do, or nothing he thought he couldn't do?
Yeah, the second one. He thought he could do everything. And he did an okay job, but you kind of looked at it at the end and went, how did that last? Or how were we not electrocuted or something like that? He was self-taught.
Tell me about your dad's shed. What was that like?
Dad's shed was, we had a granny flat out the back and then a garage, and he had kind of occupied all that space. So then he eventually added a shed on the back of the granny flat, and it just organically grew with panels that he collected from here and there and bits of wood. And then he jerry-rigged an electrical cord from the house out to the shed and made it his own little man cave. And it was okay early on, you know. He would often build things for me in there, cricket bats. And
what was your dad's cricket bat like to use?
Oh, it was terrible, you know. It was just a square piece of wood, you know, painted white, kind of heavy for an eight-year-old, you know. And, you know, splinters in my hands. Because I said, "Dad, I want a cricket bat." And he's like, "Look, I'll make you a cricket bat." And I'm like, "Okay, that's my cricket bat? Thanks, Dad." I mean, he's very proud of it, and I used it, and the other kids laughed at me. And eventually I said, "Oh, come on, Dad, buy me a nice cheap cricket bat." But, yeah, he had that about him. You know, he was ingenious, and he took pride in his work. And we supported him in it, because Mum and I didn't know any better.
What about a veggie garden? Did your family have one of those great Greek veggie gardens?
Sadly, we fit the stereotypical mold there, that we had tomatoes and cucumbers and lettuces, and yeah, it often made the evening salad, you know. And when you were a kid at the time, you saw this oily Greeky salad with big chunks of misshapen feta cheese, and you kind of, and these olives that, you know, you tasted bitter in your mouth, and you're like, "Oh, I don't want to eat that." You
and
know?
That's now what I pay a lot for in a cafe.
So do I. It's amazing how it's worked out like that. But that's just how it was. You know, that's just what Mum and Dad knew. So we had the backyard shed and the handmade goods and the garden vegetables.
What kind of health were your Mum and Dad in when you were growing up?
Mum and Dad were indecent health, and they became parents when they were 44. So I sort of remember them. Let's see, I was 6-7 years old. They were in their 50s, so they were okay, and they were very active. Obviously, you know, Dad worked until he was about 60 years old. Had the garden to keep them busy, but just slowly, you know, in their 60s, you know, medical conditions started happening. I was often, having to accompany them to appointments with specialists, to translate for them. Their English was okay, but when a doctor started talking about something technical, they kind of looked at me. And we had the odd, drama, sort of rushes to the emergency ward in the middle of the night when Dad had a fast heart rate or Mum had some issue, something like that.
What got you interested in studying genetics?
I can't lie and say that growing up around that didn't impact me, that I wanted to do something that helped people. And I kind of looked at it and thought, well, I could be a doctor, someone who works in an emergency ward or a GP or a specialist, or I could do something which helped the doctors. And what do doctors use? They use medicines. So that kind of got me in, where do medicines come from? Oh, they come from companies and they come from researchers who are developing them in laboratories. At the time when I was starting to get into that work, a very big international push was the Human Genome Project. So it was touted as something that would fix all diseases. We wouldn't have any more problems once we'd worked out these 3 billion letters to the genome. So there was an opportunity to study genetics through that.
It was just when you were about to begin your PhD in genetics that your mum appeared at your bedroom door. What kind of mood did she seem to be in?
Sneaky. obviously something was up. I remember that. It was a hot summer's day. It was January. And I was, packing away my undergraduate textbooks, putting away my old life and preparing for my new life, which was to do a PhD in medical research. And Mum was sort of gravitating around my door, and she obviously had something on her mind. And she said, "Are you busy?" And I said, "Yes, I'm doing something here." And I sort of focused on my work. And she kind of came back 5 minutes later and said, "Oh, you're still going?" I'm like, yeah, it's going to be a while here. And eventually she said, "Look, I've got something to talk to you about, but you're obviously busy, so I'll come back and get you when you're not busy."
What name did she call you, Peter, when she had something serious to talk to you about?
My Greek name, which is Panayoti. So she calls me Peter. But yeah, when it's something like, when you're in trouble, your parents call you by your full name.
And was she using your full name at this point?
Yeah. She was saying Panayoti. So there was something on her mind. Again, it comes back to what I grew up with. I thought, she's sick. Something's happened. She's got some diagnosis. She went, saw a doctor. I wasn't at that appointment. And she's going to tell me what they found. So I knew there was something serious happening.
What did she tell you?
Well, Mum, eventually I sort of caved in and said, "Look, you're not going to, dance that dance with me. Let's talk now." So she took me to her room and she sat me down. Oh, well, she sat down actually. And I said, "Look, I'll just keep standing and just tell me what's going on here." And she said, "Look, when I was young, as you know, I, struggle to have kids. I've told you that I had 3 miscarriages before you came on the scene, and that we were very blessed when you came on the scene because we'd had these issues having children. And you haven't been back to Greece at all since you've been alive, and we haven't been back to Greece. But what happened was that I was unable to have children, and that my brother actually proposed that they have a child and they give the baby to us to take to Australia. So the news is that we're actually not your mum and dad, we're your aunt and uncle. And you've got a set of parents in Greece who you've never met, and you've got, and you've also got 2 brothers you've never met. And I grew up as an only child."
Peter, how did you take this? How did you react to this news? I mean,
a lot of mixed emotions.
Was it a complete shock?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It wasn't, you had no sense or hint that this, things had not been as you,
no,
they
I,
looked.
I mean, look, so when I was a kid, we teased each other in the schoolyard, and kids said, "You're adopted." And I didn't know what to make of it. I just thought they were teasing me. But I also probably told 50 other kids that they were adopted. That's just what happened. But then when she... And there's also that thought of this woman who's been your mother your whole life and has been your number one is suddenly telling you she's not your mother. Well, you know, who the hell are you?
So she was telling you, I'm your aunt.
I'm your aunt, yeah.
And your mother and father are back in Greece. Yeah. Did you know this couple in Greece? Had you had any contact with them over the years?
No, I hadn't. Just the odd, phone call. But just to say, come say hello to your aunt and uncle, you know, or come say hello to your cousins. But there was never any hint that it was them. But the things that I remember from growing up was that I was a very conspicuous child, in that I was the only Greek kid at primary school in my class, so I stood out. My parents were so much older than all the other kids' parents. You know, the other kids had parents in their late 20s and early 30s. My parents at that stage were in their 50s, 20-year difference. And also, I was the only kid at school who didn't have siblings. So when she told me this, it all made sense, that there was something that had happened, and that's what had happened.
And why hadn't they told you before, or why was she choosing this moment to let you know this?
In retrospect, it would have been nice to have been told a few years earlier, but Mum was picking that moment because Mum and Dad were very proud of my studious nature, that I'd progressed through school and that I'd gone to university. That was a really big deal for them. And they didn't want to do anything to derail my studies because they'd heard, you know, horror stories of kids who found out they were adopted and they kind of went off the rails. You know, they rejected the family, they, you know, quit their jobs and just, you know, all lost all normality in their life because what they thought they were wasn't it anymore. So Mum waited till I went to university, and that took 6 years in undergrad. And then I said, oh, I'm going to do a 3 more years PhD. She's like, yeah, no, I can't let this go on any longer. I've got to tell you now, and I hope you'll be okay.
Were you angry?
One of the emotions, yes. I was, as you said, well, you hit on that. I was shocked. That's the initial one, you know, that you sort of, I started standing up opposite my mum, and then I sort of leant against the wall, and then I slouched against the wall, and then by the end of her explanation, I was on the floor on my hands and knees. I sort of leant back against the wall with my hands on my knees. So I was shocked at the news. I was angry and, you know, deceived. You know, why didn't you just? It was almost like, well, you didn't trust me. You know, why didn't you tell me this earlier? I'm cool with it. And then I was also curious and excited.
Was everybody in your biological family still alive back in Greece?
So this happened in 1999, and my biological dad was alive, my brothers were alive, but my biological mum had passed away. And that was a major thing that my mum harked on, because she said, look, I've denied you the opportunity to meet her. She died in 1993, it was 6 years ago, and the fact that you didn't get a chance to meet her was my fault. If I told you earlier, you might have thought, let's go and meet her. And I do remember, at that point, I remembered when my biological mum died, because my mum was really upset. And I said, why are you so upset? My dad said, oh, your aunt has died. And I thought, oh, Mum, you're upset because your sister has died. And my dad said, no,
Your mum's sister-in-law.
Yeah, her sister-in-law. And I went, oh, so not her sister. Oh, well, why is Mum so upset? You know, I kind of laughed it off a little bit. But she was upset because my mother had died.
So she had that guilt, perhaps, that you hadn't known her, had a chance, and she hadn't had a chance to see you as a grown-up.
Yeah, and Mum thought, I will get to that, and she didn't get to it in time. So she felt guilty for that. So when she was telling me, you know, she was welling up and getting emotional because she was kind of saying, please forgive me that you didn't have that opportunity. It's my fault.
What photos did she show you?
She brought out photos of all four family members, and one of them was a photo of my brothers, which had sat on our wall for many years. And I thought, I often walk past it and I thought, why has Mum put that photo up?
Of my cousins.
Of my cousins, when I've got 50 first cousins, because mum was one of four kids and dad was one of six. So there were cousins everywhere, both in Australia and Greece. But those two guys sat on my wall. But when she told me I was adopted, that's when I properly looked at the photo.
And what did you see?
That's when I started seeing resemblances. And, I mean, you know, I often looked at photos of my dad, my adoptive dad, and looked for resemblances. And sometimes I saw things that were there and some of them, well, I don't have dad's hairline or dad's chin. So, yeah, when I'm looking at my brothers and my biological mum and biological dad, I'm looking for resemblances at that point in time.
And I guess what all of these things that must have been kind of crowding into your head one after the other, Peter, but one was, okay, my mum is actually my aunt, but my dad, well, he's not genetically related to me at all.
That's true.
So what was the first conversation with your dad like after this news?
Well, dad was an old school bloke. You know, he didn't like to talk about many things to do with matters of the heart, you know.
He was busy in his shed.
Yeah, basically. That's woman's business, you know, which was partly the prevailing attitude at the time. But it was also, he kind of felt a bit more justified in it because it was his wife's family. So I think my mum probably had said to my dad, look, I'm going to tell him and I'll tell you when I've told him and then, you know, let's just see how the new dynamic establishes itself. But mum did say to me, look, when you see your dad, just give him a hug and a kiss and tell him that you know, and if you feel comfortable and that you're happy with this news, then tell him that it's okay and we'll work out a way forward. So I think I did do that. I did just give dad a hug and a kiss and we almost didn't talk about it overtly, what we went through after that. We just got on with it. Then we started talking about my brothers and my biological dad, and that was in the conversation, but there was no major moment with my dad where it was just all unsaid, you know.
What did your mum want you to do with this news, do you think?
Part of it was obviously to tell me the truth, so that I knew where I was from. And then other things came out during the conversation. And so the other part of it was that she felt burdened, you know, with this secret that she'd carried for 24 years. And then, you know, things occurred to me, like being in the emergency department at 4 o'clock in the morning when I was 15 years old and my friends were studying for exams or sleeping or something, and mum was sitting there having her blood, you know, checked. And then I thought, oh, so at that moment, mum was probably thinking, what if something happens to me and I'm not the person who got to tell him the truth. And so she said to me, I often thought, what if I died and you didn't find out the truth? What if you then found it out from someone else? What would you think of me?
What kind of relationship did she want you to have then with this sudden two brothers and other father?
I think mum wanted them to be part of my life. She'd kind of prepared me for it in that she always spoke Greek to me when I was growing up, because she knew the day would come, and she hoped for it in her heart, you know, that I would go to Greece and that I would need to converse with my biological family. I don't think she didn't put any pressure on me. She didn't say, you know, you've got to go to Greece next week or even next year. She just said, this is the truth, and I hope you go. I hope you meet them. From what I gather, they're lovely people. I hope you still have us in your life. And, you know, at that age, I was 24 and I could kind of be an adult about it and make my own decisions. I could have moved to Greece if I'd wanted to and had a, you know, some time there and gotten to know them. But she didn't put any pressure on me.
Was there a part of you that wanted to go straight away or not?
To be honest with you, I was still in a bit of shock. I wanted to let the news sink in and be comfortable with it and throw it around in my head and talk to my friends about it, but I didn't want to face it. I couldn't. It was still too much to actually. I wanted to live with the news for a little while and then have phone calls and share some more photos and just sort of ease our way into this new relationship. But, yeah, I couldn't go quickly. I couldn't go quickly, and also I'd sort of committed to doing a PhD. I was about to embark on research into genetics, and I was excited about that. And so I thought there will be some time. I will get there, and I will have warmed up to it.
Whereabouts in Greece is the village that your family come from?
They're from the northern part of Greece. I was a bit disappointed that they're not from some...
No island.
No glorious, idyllic, picturesque, sun-drenched island, Yeah, they're from a rural part of Greece. It is beautiful. It's in the mountains. It's only about half an hour from the borders of Albania and now the country known as North Macedonia. So it is in the Macedonia part of Greece, and the town is called Florina. There's like snow fields nearby and big lakes.
So this was where your mum had grown up, but where had her family come from before getting to that village?
So they were... Greek Orthodox Christians who were living in Turkey. So they were living there. And now this is when I was trying to understand where the family came from. Mum was trying to convey this as best she could. But her father lived in Turkey with his wife, and they had six kids. Two of them passed away. And Mum was the youngest one. So Mum was actually born in Greece, and they went to Greece during there was a Greco-Turkish war, which happened and ended in, about 1920. And then there was a massive population exchange between Turkey and Greece. So all the Greek Orthodox Christians in Turkey were told to go to Greece, and then the Turkish Muslims went the other way.
How were they received when they got to Greece?
Well, Greece had lost this war with Turkey. So the Greeks that they weren't treated well in that, there weren't medical supplies and that sort of thing. And then the Greeks met them with a sense of suspicion, that these were people who had lived with the enemy. So how are we going to take them? Are they here to spy on us? Tensions have always been, tense between those two countries, let alone, what they were like 100 years ago. So, yeah, they were, my grandparents were refugees who left Turkey and went to Greece.
What did they bring with them from home?
My papu, my grandfather, just carried some soil, and then he... they got a little plot of property, and he planted some orange trees and used the soil from that, so that they carried a little bit of that with them. But it was, these are 100-kilometer chains of people who are walking with chickens in cages in one hand and horses and donkeys, and it was just like a chain of human misery, basically snaking its way through Turkey to get to the water and then catch these rickety, fishing vessels. They settled in the north of Greece because those were newly won lands, and the country needed people in those lands.
So, there was a period then of poverty, and then there was the Greek Civil War, and then there's that whole other stage of emigration where people are leaving Greece for other parts of the world. Who was the first person in your mum's family to leave that village and come to Australia?
So, yeah, Mum was one of four kids, two boys, two girls, and her brother, Vangeli, was a man of action, and he heard about people migrating to Australia, and he said, "I'm not staying here in this broken-down country, in this broken-down town, and I'm going to make something of my life." I mean, he'd done his military service in the Greek army, and he'd travelled to Switzerland and places like that, so he's... idea of the world was bigger than this little village mindset. So he came out to Australia. Australia was welcoming people then. It was populate or perish after World War II that the country needed to bolster its stocks. And he ended up in Queanbeyan, which is a town just next to Canberra. And they all worked as sort of building labourers and just jack of all trades, really.
And who did he meet in Queanbeyan who becomes an important part of your story?
He met a lot of, you know, other Greek men, but one Greek man he met was a young man named Vasilios, and they connected because he was from the same village in Greece, from
what
Florina.
Are the chances? Here we are in Queen Bien.
Well, it's not too small a I probably should call it a town more than a village, but yeah, it's not every family knows every other family, but yeah, when you have that connection, it's like, oh, you know, we talk about the old country and that sort of thing.
And this is the fellow whose anglicised name is Bill and who becomes your dad.
Mm-hmm.
So who did they, your uncle and your dad, who did they decide to sponsor to bring out from the village in Greece?
So my uncle Vangeli had a fiancée, his plan was, look, I'm going to go out to Australia, I'm going to set things up there, and then after a few years you will come over and we will make our lives there. And he said he met my father Bill, and he said, oh, it just so happens that I've got a couple of sisters, and I think the youngest one is the most eligible. Her name's Elizabeth, and here's a photo of her. And my Bill looked at it and went, oh, she looks nice, you know, he's a handsome young bachelor. And it was arranged that my uncle's fiancée and his sister would come out to Australia, so they caught a boat, which took 6 weeks, I think it was, a lot of seasickness, and then they eventually docked in Fremantle and then in Melbourne, and then my uncle Vangeli and my father Bill came down with one of their mates in an old Bedford truck, picked up the girls, took them back to Canberra, Queen Bien. And I remember Mum was saying, she was shocked, you know, because this enormous country and all this open space and travelling, you know, the equivalent of the Hume Highway between Melbourne and Canberra, just like, where is everybody? Why is it so dry? Why are there no leaves on any trees? You know, everything looks dead. How can I possibly have a living here?
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Peter, your mum came out on the boat to meet your dad. Was it just automatic that they'd get married, or did they actually have the chance to kind of get to know each other a bit and decide if this was going to be a good idea?
Oh, they had a chance to get to know each other. I often asked my mum, I said, was it an arranged marriage? Because, you know, it's kind of a sexy thing to say that, you know, parents were arranged. She said, oh, no, it wasn't arranged. It was organised. It was... which is true. I mean, there was always a chance for her to back out, you know, if she saw something she was really put off by. And there were plenty of Greek brides who came out to Australia, and some ladies that the mum knew, and they said, this isn't for me, and they packed up and went home. So mum and dad had a chance to get to know each other, but they couldn't take forever. So they met in August of 1956. And they got married in October 1956.
How did your dad propose?
Your dad had a motorbike, so they would go riding together through the bush, and Mum would often pack a picnic and take little things here and there, like, you know, feta cheese and olives. There was a Greek shop or a shop in Queen Bien which did provide some of those things. They'd get them down from Sydney like once a month, that sort of thing. So Dad, he actually had an engagement ring, and when Mum wasn't looking, he hid it in the taramo salata, which was the fish dip. Yeah.
It's like she didn't swallow it.
Oh, well, she found it, and then she dusted it off and put it on her finger, and then they ate the rest of the dip.
What was their first house together like in Canberra?
There was a suburb where they put all the labourers, basically, called Narrabunda, and they had all these prefabricated cottages. So it was, you know, not a very warm house to suffer through Canberra winters. I think it had two bedrooms, it had floorboards, and the whole street looked like identical. It looked like a movie set.
It must have been such a contrast to what your mum was used to. Was she lonely, do you think?
Oh, yeah, she told me she was lonely. Dad would go to work and she would sit all day at home. He eventually bought a radio for her to keep her company, and maybe she could learn a bit of English through the radio. There were a few Greek ladies and friends here and there, but Mum didn't drive. You know, Dad didn't let Mum drive. He was the man of the house. Didn't let Mum work as well. And then after a few years, Mum's like, look, I'm going crazy here. Because from Dad's perspective, it was like, you know, your job is to be a mum. We're going to have a family and you will look after the children. So there is no need for you to learn how to drive because I can drive you anywhere. And there's definitely no need for you to work because that's not your job.
But those kids didn't turn up.
No, they didn't. They didn't come. Mum, they got married in 56 and... During the 1960s, it was just one disappointment after another. Mum did fall pregnant, but she had three miscarriages, and they were very early on.
And that, you know, of course, would have been heartbreaking for your mum and your dad. And was there also, on top of that, a lot of pressure in that community that, as a good Greek wife, she should be producing children?
Yeah, yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there. Mum was very... embarrassed, ashamed. Dad's mother came over from Greece for a visit and she would whisper in my mum's ear and say, you know, I had six kids by the time I was your age. You're not much of a woman, are you? You know, you married my son, you promised him grandkids. It didn't matter that she had 20 other grandkids, you know. She looked at her son Bill and her heart went out to him that he hadn't been able to have his own kids. And then there were the communities, the gatherings that they would get together at, and everyone had little kids running around and chaos, and Mum and Dad were this lovely, childless, you know, from the perspective of other people, you know, a bit sad, you know, pitiful, that these people can't have their own kids. They won't know the joy that they will know. So, yeah, they were supported, but there was that sense of yearning that these people aren't complete.
And what kind of effect was it having on their marriage, their relationship with one another?
Oh, tension, you know. There were moments of, I mean, I wasn't there, but, you know, Mum said there was conflict and there was... Yeah, finger pointing, and they were times when Mum doubted whether the marriage would last, whether her husband would just get sick of this and say, look, you know, this isn't worked out the way it has. So she worried about what that would mean for her life. She was in her 30s now, mid-30s.
Did they consider adopting a child in Australia? What did your dad think about the idea of adopting a kid in Australia?
Didn't like it. Didn't. Oh, this sounds awful, but he didn't want some. He didn't want some mongrel, you know, Australian, British, Irish heritage, you know,
some convict.
Yeah, Mark. You know, he wanted a Greek baby. So it got to the extent of him sending. So he sent my mum when she went back to Greece in 1973 to visit her dad, who was unwell. So the mum and dad had been married now for 17 years, had three miscarriages. They were now 43 years old. They had almost all but given up. And they said, well, right, we've got to try and adopt. So mum was going home to visit her father, my papu, and dad said, look, while you're in Greece, go to Thessaloniki, which is the major city in Greece's north, and try to get a Greek baby. Off you go.
From anywhere in particular?
There were orphanages, yeah.
And how did that go?
Oh, it didn't go well. First of all, Mum turned up on her own, you know, to plead her case. And the people in the orphanage were like, well, where's your husband? And she's like, well, he's in Australia. And they're like, well, hang on a minute. You live in Australia? So let me get this straight. You propose to take one of our precious Greek babies to Australia... And your husband's not even here to... And she's like, yeah. And they're like, and how much do you earn? And what does your husband do? And they're like, no babies for poor people, let alone people who live in Australia. So Mum was crestfallen at this point. She went back to her family in Florina, and her brother and her father knew that she'd gone to try and adopt a baby. And they were sitting around, and her brother just said to her, look, I've had enough, quite frankly. I've seen you. You're my baby sister. You've gone off to Australia 17 years ago now. You've been trying to have a family and a life with this man. I've never met him. He seems to be okay, but what can I do to help you? Well, what I can do is, what if I have a baby?
He can't have a baby. What do you mean? What if my wife and me can have a baby?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he blurted it out, you know, and then...
Was his wife even there?
No. No, I think, I mean, he blurted out the proposition, and I think he wanted to see if she was interested, my mum, and if she was interested, then he'd talk to his wife.
So how did your mum react?
Well, she couldn't believe it. You know, really? You would do that? I'd never even thought that to ask whether you would do that. And he said, well, of course we can do that. I'd need to talk to my wife. But she was overjoyed with the idea of it. And then a few days passed, and it was all green-lighted, basically. And Mum talked to my biological mother and said, look, this is wonderful. I can't believe you're doing this, and I'm so grateful.
Why did she agree, do you think, your biological mum? Do you know what was going on for her?
I'm really detached from that side of the... I've tried to get a sense from my brothers. My brothers were 10 years older than me, so they were well aware of what was happening. But look, I can just sort of... I can speculate and just say that, look, it must have been... You know, it's the greatest gift, you know, to imagine that you're going to fall pregnant, you're going to have a baby, and the baby will eventually get taken away. And you're doing it not even for your brother or sister, you're doing it for your husband's sister.
Do you think religion played a part in that?
Yeah, I think more society might have played a part in that, that Greece was a very patriarchal society. And I think I can probably safely say that there might not have been pressure to do it, but that my biological dad probably said, look, this is what's happening, and we're going to do our best to make it happen. If it doesn't happen, that's fine, but I think we should do something for my sister.
So your biological mum and dad already had these two boys together, yeah, who were 10 and 12. Did it take them long to get pregnant with another child?
Well, it didn't, actually. I mean, it only happened a few months later. You know, even the fact that they were in their 40s, but it was just the fact that they'd had kids before, so the plumbing, the machinery was all there, it was all tickety-boo. So my mum's sister wrote to her mum and said, yeah, Savas and Anna are pregnant, so the baby will be born next June, and you're welcome to come over, and we'll hopefully you're here in time for the birth, and then we can... take it from there.
How did your mum first see you?
Mum actually missed the birth. She didn't arrive in, or I came early, actually. So she met her sister in Thessaloniki, and they caught the train back to Florina. And Mum walked in the living room, into the house, into the living room, and there I was. It was the same family she'd seen only a year ago, you know, her brother, his wife, the two boys, and suddenly there's this little baby there. So, you know, she's overcome with emotion and, you know, takes me in her arms and starts to get to know me.
And was there any question or anxiety that your birth parents might change their mind and not hand you over, as they'd agreed?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think our mum, when she was boarding the plane, she thought, look, you know, what if I get there and they've changed their minds? And her sister was kind of trying to make sure that didn't happen. She was saying, you make sure you get here and you know, make sure you take charge of the situation, you know, be first to change the baby's nappy. Don't kind of give them any sense of that this is not going to happen. She was just worried that something would change.
Were you baptised in Greece, Peter?
Well, the original plan that... So my mum came over to Greece to pick me up. It was from her family. It was a gift from her family. And, well, what do you think my dad did? He stayed in Australia. So he stayed in Australia to keep earning money and keep working and whatnot. And he didn't know how many months it would take. But he said to her, look, bring the baby back unbaptized. I want there to be a celebration here in Australia. We'll do the baptism here. But I was a month old, and then in July 1974, there was, guess what, conflict with Turkey again. An invasion of Cyprus and, you know, battleships and Greece went into lockdown. The airports closed and my mum suddenly feeling very anxious. She's like, how long is this going to be, you know, go on? It could go on for months. I won't be able to get back to Australia. And the decision was made, we better baptise all these babies quickly, because if they don't and something happens, they're all going to hell. So my mum and my biological mum took me down to the nearby church, and there was like a whole line of people with unbaptised babies, and they were suddenly quick all there to get their ticket to heaven. And my two mothers stood there, and they baptised me.
I wonder if they explained to the priest what was going on, or just the two of them there with you. It's kind of lovely they were both there.
Yeah, it is actually. He kind of looked at them funnily and said, what's going on here? I said only one person should be here, you know, because there were lots of people. And they tried to explain the situation, and he went, look, whatever, I'm really busy today. Let's just do it.
When your two mums said goodbye to each other and you were brought back to Australia, did you bring anything back with you from your birth parents?
I had a crucifix, and the traditional thing that Greeks wear with crucifixes, the evil eye. So I was wearing those things, or had them around my wrist. And Mum held on to them when she came back to Australia, and she still has them at home, and she showed them to me.
Did she tell you anything about what that goodbye was like?
She said it was very emotional, and, I don't think my biological mum expected to... that there would be as impactful on her as it ended up being. There were tears. My aunt was kind of celebrating, because she's like, yay, they're going. It's you know, the deal has been done, you know, because she wondered if it would happen, like if there would be a change of mind, especially if I'd come out a girl as well, because if I'd been born a girl, maybe they would have thought, we've got two boys, now we've got a girl, we're not going to let the girl go. But when I came out a boy, that kind of, you know...
that helped seal the deal.
A little bit more. So, yeah, it was an emotional farewell, and Mum was kind of wondering, now she was on her own now, and she flew back to Australia, and as it turned out, when I spoke to my brother, when I eventually met him, it was a case of, you do realise that nobody spoke for about 10 days after you left.
What do you mean nobody spoke?
The house was just in mourning. It's like there'd been a death in the household. There was a member of a family of five, and now they weren't there anymore. So they were in mourning, and especially my mum, my biological mum, she absolutely took it to heart that it had all been hypothetical, or all been speculation, and then finally it had happened, and it was like being sucked into a vacuum. So yeah, it was pretty sad when I found that out.
So this is the story that is revealed to you when you're in your mid-20s, and the years go on and you manage to do this PhD, and finally it's time for you to go to Greece. What were your first impressions when you arrived in the village?
When you go to that part of Greece, there is it's not the most picturesque part compared to, you know, the islands. So there are car bodies and stray dogs and overgrown fields and that sort of thing. It's a very agricultural part of Greece. So it wasn't the most auspicious of returns. I actually did make my mum come back, because I said, look, you've been there throughout. I am not going back to Greece without you. You're going to be there for this reunion to metaphorically hold my hand and walk me through it. The unfortunate thing that had happened was that my father, my biological father, had passed away in 2001. I was sad that I didn't make it to Greece in time, and I missed out on meeting him. But as I said, the way I sort of look back on it was the fact that I didn't meet my biological mum was my mum's fault. And the fact that I didn't meet my biological dad was mine. I do regret it now, because I thought, what was I afraid of? You know, what could have possibly happened? It could have only have been good, you know. But part of that fear and reluctance was the thought that I've already got a mum and dad. I don't really deep down want to get to know another one.
But you didn't have any brothers, and you did now have two brothers. What was it like to meet them?
Yeah, that was the excitement. You know, it was scary, but it was exciting. It was exciting because they were more of my age. You know, we could hang out and drink coffee and go to bars and talk about girls. You know, it's not really the kind of stuff you're going to do with your with your dad. So, absolutely, it was exciting.
How did they introduce you to their friends?
They introduced me as the little one. The in Greece they say omikros. Omikros ifte, ifte omikros. You know, the little one's here, the little one's here.
Did you have the sense that they'd been waiting 26, 27, 28 years for you to come back?
Oh, absolutely. And my brother George, who's the middle brother, he had often wanted to come out to Australia and meet me, like especially when he had like arguments with his mum and dad. He's like, you know, you can ground me and you can, you know, take away my privileges, but I know something about this family, this deep secret, and I'm going to blow it apart. I'm going to get on a plane and I'm going to go to Australia and I'm going to meet my brother, because that's one thing that he could do. So by the time I got there, when I was, you know, now 28, 29 years old, he was 40 years old. So, yeah, he'd absolutely told everybody in the village, and our other brother Billy had told everyone.
What kind of relationship do your two older brothers have with one another?
Yeah, that's an interesting relationship as well. So, and it does explain the story a little bit more, is that I have two brothers, Yorgo and Vasily, George and Billy. Billy's the eldest, and there was something that happened in our village in the 1960s, and again, I've talked to members of the family and tried to work out what it was, but it was some illness that swept through the village, and I can probably equate it to something like meningitis, because George said to me, some kids died, some kids went blind, some kids lost limbs, and what happened to our brother Billy was that his brain didn't develop, so he's intellectually disabled now. And he is, like, he is not in a wheelchair or anything like that. He walks around town, and he's the size of a gorilla. He's huge and strong. But, you know, he can't prepare his dinner, and he doesn't have his own shower and, you know, dresses himself, that sort of thing. So George has effectively become his carer. The two of them have remained unmarried.
Living in the same house that you were born in?
Yep, the same house they grew up in Florina. The house has been slowly upgraded over the years, but no major renovations. It's this little sugar cube that sits on this hill, and all the houses around it have all been demolished, and these big flats have gone up. So it really kind of sticks out. And it's not far from the centre of town either, because it's been there nearly 100 years now. So the unfortunate thing that my aunt, remember the aunt who was celebrating, saying, yes, you know, go to Australia, have a life there. I think she was genuinely projecting forward and looking at the fact that the day will come when George will become Billy's carer, that the older generation, they'll all pass away and George will just have to give up his life to look after his brother. My biological dad was very suspicious of the state and the state-run institutions. He didn't want his eldest son going to sanatorium or anything like that. He'd heard horror stories about shock therapy, and they went, nah, this is our boy. He is who he is. We will look after him the way we see fit. We are not going to send him to somewhere like that.
So on one hand, Peter, these two men are kind of strangers, but they're also your brothers. Did you feel a sense of extra responsibility, given that your eldest brother has a mental impairment and your other brother is caring for him? I mean, how did you imagine that you would fit in that dynamic?
I felt guilty that I couldn't do more. You know, I thought, I mean, the darkest part of me thought, when I turn up in the village, George is going to go, okay, you're here, catch you later, I'm off to travel the world. You look after our brother now for 6 months. I've done my bit.
Is that what happened?
No, that didn't happen. It turns out that they're supportive of all I'd done, and they knew everything I'd progressed academically, and they were very proud of me. And I said to them at the end of that first meeting, I said, so what happens now? And they said, well, look, you go back to your life and you do us proud. You know, we keep in touch over the years. Finances have gotten tight for them in Greece, and I've sent money, where I could, so that they could buy a new car and renovate the house, new bathroom. And George sometimes wouldn't get paid from his job for months on end. And it's just him and Billy now. And exactly what my aunt had projected would happen has happened. Yeah, the way that she looked at it was, my nephews are not going to have the chance to have their own children. The only hope for the family of continuing is if this boy, this baby, goes far away, has his own life, and hopefully has better luck.
So, Peter, are you continuing the Papathanasiou line?
Yeah, I've been fortunate to meet a girl in 2007. So that was 4 years after I met my brothers. She became my wife, Jane, and we had our own issues with conceiving. It turned out that Jane had endometriosis and needed surgery for that. They kind of said to us, well, look, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't work. So off you go, good luck. As it turned out, we've had two children, and there's one more which is on the way now. So my brothers are very proud of that, and they look at exactly that. They go, he's done it. The line will, our name will continue.
What about your mum? How does she take to being a grandma after having struggled to have her own child for so long?
Oh, she loves it. Her only regret is that she could have been a bit younger. Mum was 85 when she became a grandmother. It's very different to becoming a grandmother in your 60s. But she still lives on her own. We live nearby, and Mum will cook for the boys. We can leave them with her for a few hours. She does as much as she can. For a woman who's nearly 90 years old, to still be able to do these things is a blessing. They haven't met their uncles in Greece yet, so I'm looking forward to that day. Unfortunately, my dad passed away, but the gift that I kind of gave him was that he did become a papu, a grandfather, before he died, and he got to see, the next generation. And, that was a big thing for him, because he thought, look, we did all this work and now our son's having issues conceiving. But when you think about it, we've got medical science and doctors, and we can get diagnoses of endometriosis now, and we can do treatments to treat them. But there was nothing like that in the 1960s and 1950s. So people kind of found village solutions for these problems, and it was just the family looking after itself. And even with my brother Billy, who's intellectually impaired, there's a village solution that was found there. We just keep going.
Peter, it's extraordinary story that you've told. Thank you so much for sharing it with us on Conversations.
Thank you very much for having me.
Peter Papathanasiou, and his memoir is Little One. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.